As long as movies have had sound, they've had jazz. In 1927, the first talkie was released, and it was called The Jazz Singer, directed by Alan Crosland and starring Al Jolson. The movie tells the story of Jackie Rabinowitz, whose stage name is Jack Robin. He defies his Jewish father to become a jazz singer instead of taking over the temple. The music aspect centers around the sort of great American songbook numbers, songs like Waiting for the Robert E. Lee, Robert E. Lee in that case referring to a ship. Pieces that toe the line between full-blown jazz and ragtime pop. The trend would continue into the very expensive 30s musicals. These would be centered around extended dance sequences featuring people like Fred Astaire. Again, jazz composition was very important to these musicals, but jazz performance significantly less so. The climax of The Jazz Singer is Jack performing Mother of Mine, I Still Have You. As some of you may already know, this song, as well as the rest of his climactic show, is performed in blackface. The major misconception of the movie is that the whole thing is in blackface, but the reality isn't much better, or any better. As a side note, this movie would be remade 4 times, including a version starring Neil Diamond and Laurence Olivier, released in 1980. And yes, Neil Diamond does blackface. In the scene, it's meant to be a joke, but still. I assume it may have been to distract from the fact that Laurence Olivier also has a history of doing blackface. The Jazz Singer is remembered to this day, but only partly for its numbers. For the most part, people know about it because of the controversy surrounding the blackface scenes or because it's the first sound movie. But still, it's a movie that left its mark because of that, because of technology. However, I think that technology says more about the music it was about than the movie it was about.
You ain't heard nothing. You want to hear Choo-choo-choo-choo? All right, hold on, hold on.
No, listen. Play Choo-choo-choo-choo. 3 choruses, you understand? And the 3rd chorus, I whistle. Now give it to him hard and heavy. Go right ahead.
Choo-choo-choo-choo. Goodbye.
Choo-choo-choo-choo. Don't cry.
The little choo-choo train that takes me away from you. You don't know just how sad it makes me. Kiss me pretty and then, ow, do it over again.
Louis Armstrong from New Orleans, Louisiana, may be the most beloved jazz musician today, though he's in fairly legendary company. Nicknamed Satchmo because of his puffed-up cornetist cheeks, he was a part of the transition from Dixieland to small combo jazz. One of the first superstars of jazz music, he's had his part in over 40 movies and is one of the faces of the genre. He also holds a substantial Billboard record, being the oldest person thus far to release a number one single, Hello Dolly, which he recorded at 62 years old. Hello Dolly also ended the Beatles' 1964 streak of number one singles.
Hello Dolly, this is Louis Dolly. Funny glad to have you back where you belong. You lookin' swell.
If you ask any person, random or jazz fan, who the king of jazz is, Armstrong is likely the name you'll hear. Despite that, the question of who's the king of jazz actually has a definitive answer, technically. The person you may not know, however, their name's Paul Whiteman, who is, yes, a white man. Paul Whiteman came out of a 40-piece Navy back in 1910s before moving to California and eventually New York, playing hotels and Broadway musicals. He's a very controversial band leader, both then and now, because as a jazz musician, he emphasized composition, downplayed jazz rhythms, and tried to minimize improvisation. He was as un-jazz as a serious jazz band leader could be, and so his popularity led to him being called the King of Jazz, even so far as to get a 1930 film about him called The King of Jazz. It did not make a lot of people happy, even at the time. A lot of jazz at the time was more ragtime pop music, so that's not totally surprising that his style was a part of it. However, it's ruined his legacy. The movie also can't really be called a feature film. It's a collection of song numbers with sketches connecting them. Again, jazz movies really haven't been about jazz. They've been about movies that are jazz-connected, or I guess about jazz, but not in a way people today would really want. So what happened to the King of Jazz? Well, the title was always controversial. When a poll was conducted by the Pittsburgh Courier, Duke Ellington won, not Paul Whiteman. When Time magazine ran a King of Jazz cover in 1949, it was a picture of Louis Armstrong. The Paul Whiteman era was short. Really didn't last past the 1930s, and when it did last, it was because of a timing zeitgeist, marketing, the fact that he was white and a lot of other prominent jazz musicians weren't. It's like a lot of musical kingships in that way. Rap music has probably made the right move by denying people a definitive king. What happened to Paul Whiteman himself is actually more interesting, as he and his reputation was toppled by a friendly neighborhood communists. First of all, the individualist band leader style that Whiteman built his careers on was losing affection amongst most players. Jazz was a collaborative form of music. Someone like Paul Whiteman, who didn't allow for improvisation and became the face of whatever band he was a part of, that rubbed people the wrong way. As Joshua Burnett points out in his book, Louis Armstrong and Paul Whiteman, Two Kings of Jazz, quote, Whiteman was a casualty of a socialist agenda coupled with the heightened black consciousness emerging during and directly after World War II. It was a political process which effectively denied or ignored much of what he had achieved to foster the careers of such African-American musicians as Don Redman, Earl Hines, William Grant Still, Duke Ellington, and others. Much of this process was driven by issues of labor. As artists and musicians unionized, and musicians even started visiting the newly socialist Russia, the celebration of jazz became more about the artistic labor of a group, of a unit. Also, as black musicians began to have more leverage, credit began being distributed more honestly. It didn't end there, though. Paul Whiteman went to Britain to play a series of shows, forcing him to negotiate with the new musicians' unions. And even after they came to an agreement, a general strike started in Britain, and Whiteman shows had to be canceled en masse. Most people today don't know, or those who do don't really like Paul Whiteman. As opposed to other white band leaders at the time, like Benny Goodman, Paul Whiteman's image is pretty retroactively stained. Following the 1930s, jazz and films either became a part of a larger aesthetic, generally a criminal aesthetic, or was a biopic. The most notable of these was the Benny Goodman story from 1956. Early biopics, 1930s to 50s, were very idealist, literally. They were often about geniuses who operated on an expression of their superior ideas. These could be disrespected, such as Lawton's performance of Rembrandt in Rembrandt, who everyone turns against for being too visionary after his unveiling of the Night Watch. Or it can be like the Benny Goodman story, where vision's too great to be denied. To put it simply, even though jazz appreciation stepped away from the individualism of a Whiteman, the movie biopic didn't. According to Telling the Story, Representations of Jazz, Peter Townsend says, quote, the biopic hero is in each film a misfit, lacking a social or community context for his music. His achievements are of different order from those of his fellow musicians, to whom he owes little or nothing. This cuts the idea of a community of players or a shared musical culture out of the picture. This is also another explanation of the scenes with black musicians. They directly exempt the hero from any sense of obligation towards a pre-existing cultural setting. In the biopic, moreover, white and black achievement of the same standards are viewed differently. Black musicians can do it by nature, automatically, while the skill of the white hero is a mark of individual merit.
music is all Benny Goodman, played and conducted by the maestro himself. But just as wonderful, playing the starring role, is the young man whose warm and winning personality has skyrocketed him to television fame, Steve Allen. And as the girl in this exciting and most touching of true life romances, Academy Award winner, beautiful and appealing, Donna Reed.
I'm in love with you, Benny.
I guess you know how I feel.
I haven't the vaguest idea.
The Benny Goodman story is as colorful and dynamic as the era it springs from. And it's all here. Benny the boy from the streets of Chicago with his clarinet. The gay lake boats where Benny left boyhood behind. The reckless days in Chicago's gangster-dominated speakeasy.
Alongside the biopic, jazz became the scenery for movies instead of the focus of movies. Since jazz was the music of clubs, cities, expensive hotels, it became the soundtrack of lurid crime films. The new bebop jazz was often used to imply things like mania, fights, intoxication. And when France started producing their own crime films, they quickly adopted this visual audio language. By a wide margin, the most famous and respected movie in this category, both as a movie and as music, is A Censure pour l'Échafaud by Louis Malle. You may recognize one of the pieces off the soundtrack. The movie isn't about jazz either. Rather, it's another crime movie that uses jazz for the soundtrack. But what's interesting is that this is a great set led by Miles Davis. The soundtrack was recorded overnight until around 4:30 a.m. The production team played scenes for the band, who would watch and try to play along. This technique has been used before and was later used by Jim Jarmusch and Neil Young for the 1995 movie Dead Man. It's generally agreed that the set Miles Davis did for Mall's film set the foundation for the modal techniques used in Kind of Blue 2 years later. The movie also has a weird political history. Louis Malle came out of radical circles, which isn't surprising, he's a French artist. The thing is, some of these were much more fascistic than one might expect. From Pouchard's After Django, quote, Malle became close friends with Pierre-Etienne Cousteau, brother of the commandant. Pierre Cousteau was an unreformed wartime collaborator who claimed he had wanted a German victory because it represented the last chance of the white man, while the democracies represented the end of the white man. Those are Cousteau's words. He had been an editor for the far-right newspaper Rivaro, and it was via the Cousteaus that Malle was introduced to other figures of what was a shriveled post-war literary right. He was also connected to two writers who had been dubbed the Hussards. The group's work was characterized by a set of, quote, drearily familiar rightist obsessions. Going further, quote, disgust at the descent of bourgeois modern France into decadence, the shame of France's World War II and its failing colonial project. There's little doubt, though, that Malle was drawn to these anti-Semites and would-be fascists for reasons removed from their artistic program or political beliefs. Malle himself would go on to claim that his movie was not political, certainly not fascist, and any accusations of the movie's right-wing agenda are projections by the critics. Pouchard states that the movie's perhaps right-wing in a mood, but not as political themes. Film critic Raymond Bord was pretty adamant with his accusation, however. He argued the movie, quote, obliged the fantasies of the little right-wingers. Bord also cites scenes in which Germans who became decorated or profited after the war are portrayed as charismatic and cool. Following this period, jazz would become less and less relevant. However, movie brats of the 1970s, people like Woody Allen and Francis Ford Coppola, would begin to incorporate jazz into their films. In some cases, this was a major formative influence, but in a lot of cases, it seemed like they were admirers of jazz as opposed to people who grew up fans of it. Interestingly enough, Clint Eastwood directed Bird, a respected biopic with Forest Whitaker as Charlie Parker. I would argue the most notable place for jazz in film would be the jazz documentary, which actually did allow the playing, practice, music, or scene to be the focus of the film. This includes a handful of super famous films, well, super famous for jazz documentaries, Buena Vista Social Club, Let's Get Lost, and Thelonious Monk, Straight No Chaser. The lesser-known Calle 54 assembles tons of fantastic bossa nova performances. The short film Daybreak Express combines jazz with great scenic train footage from New York City. I would argue the best of the best, however, are the documentaries by Shirley Clarke. Shirley Clarke is an interesting and tenured New York City director. One of her movies, The Cool World, was among the few early examples to portray a black street gang in the more respectful, movie-ish way an Italian or Irish gang might. It's considered by some to be the first blaxploitation movie. She also made some significant jazz documentaries, and one kind of documentary. Shirley Clarke directed Ornette, Made in America, and Portrait of Jason, about a hustler and aspiring cabaret performer. Obviously, Ornette, Made in America was about Ornette. She also directed The Connection, which is a found footage movie about a film director making a documentary of heroin addicts waiting for their dealer. The movie features jazz musicians like Jackie McLean or Freddie Redd.
My name is Jason Holliday. My name is Jason Holliday. My name is Aaron Payne. I know he's around when the sky and the ground start in ringing. Everyone in New York has a gimmick. So I found out that mine was hustling. I hear in advance. Some people like museums and they spend all day looking at pictures. I spend all day looking at people. It's the same form of art. And I can make you feel that you're the most desirable human being that ever walked this earth.
Is the only music that makes me dance.
I'm a pretty frightening cat, you know. People that know me will tell you that. But, like, I don't mean any harm, but the harm is done.
I think it's about time now I picked up my gay buns and swished out.
There are actually full-on jazz movies now, such as Whiplash, and that should be a good sign, but there was such a great opportunity decades ago when jazz was the most popular kind of music, when jazz was mainstream music, and it's unlikely any movie now could achieve the cultural ubiquity of something like The Jazz Singer, because it's just past the date where a jazz movie could mean something like that. Apart from that, jazz remains mostly as setting, though it's in a good place there, considering jazz can provide the sound of both high-class and criminal environments pretty seamlessly. I bet a good editor could use the exact same piece twice for both in one movie or show. Interestingly enough, anime like Cowboy Bebop and Detective Conan, in an attempt to invoke a kind of collage of American crime or detective sensibilities, adopted jazz-adjacent soundtracks, taking advantage of 80s sax and pop clothing. The frustrating irony with jazz in movies is, while The Jazz Singer being the first sound film really makes it seem like jazz is one of the key topics of film, it's not. From the beginning, it hasn't been about the music of jazz. Well, it hasn't been about the playing of jazz. It hasn't been about the practice of doing jazz. What it's been is either playing the music that was popular at the time, which unfortunately was fairly un-jazz in a lot of situations, or it's using jazz to good scenic effect. Jazz is a great mood setter, And in that sense, it really has been with movies as really longer than any other form of music, at least in the movie itself. Because of that, if you want to know music in movies, you have to start with jazz.